Our Foreign Policy. This is the 43rd in a series of programs featuring discussions of international affairs by members of Congress and government officials. Our Foreign Policy is presented for servicemen and women everywhere by the Armed Forces Radio Service in cooperation with NBC's University of the Air. Today's discussion concerns our international information policy. Featured in today's discussion will be Mr. William Benton, Assistant Secretary of State, who is responsible for this phase of the State Department's work, Mr. William T. Stone, Director of the Office of International Information and Cultural Affairs for the State Department, Mr. Loy Henderson, Director of the Office of Near Eastern Affairs of the State Department, and until recently, Minister to Iraq, who has had first-hand experience with this type of work. Mr. Benton, Mr. Stone, and Mr. Henderson will be interviewed by Sterling Fisher of NBC's University of the Air. Here is Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Benton, the State Department has come in for some severe criticism lately for not releasing more information on our foreign policy. Would you like to define your information policy?
Well, Mr. Fisher, we're now working toward releasing as much information as possible, as fast as possible, and with a maximum of frankness. I know we haven't always lived up to these aims. We're working now on plans to improve our channels for getting the facts out to the public. But that's another story. We can't expect to cover in one broadcast both our domestic information policy and our international information program.
Yes, so we'll cover the domestic aspects in another broadcast. But I suppose the aims you mentioned apply to our international program as well.
In a general way, yes, they do. We want to get accurate information out and as fast as possible. But here at home, we are dealing with foreign policy and international relations generally. Whereas our overseas operations will be much broader. We'll be operating abroad under a special directive from President Truman. He put it this way. It should be the aim of American foreign policy to give other peoples of the world a full and fair picture of American life. Now, that concept is a revolutionary concept. Something new in the history of diplomacy. Diplomacy speaks to officials. Our information program will speak to peoples. The peoples of the world are on the march. They are already in touch with each other through the press and radio and movies. Our job is to help them to get correct information about us.
That raises a fundamental question. Why has it suddenly become necessary to dispense information about America to the whole world?
The need isn't new, Fisher, but we've only recently begun to meet that need. Stone, we've discovered that it is no longer safe to assume that the whole world believes in the purity of our motives.
You see, Mr. Fisher, we discovered in this war that we were handicapped by a lot of false notions that other people had about us. Misinformation and lack of information played right into the hands of the enemy propagandists.
Can you give us an example or two, Mr. Stone, to illustrate what you mean?
Yes. America was completely misrepresented all over Europe and the Far East by Axis propagandists early in the war. They described us as weak, divided, spineless people who would never really stand up and fight. We disproved that. But while we were arming ourselves, we had to tell the story of our growing strength to our allies, and especially to the people of occupied countries, so they wouldn't get discouraged while they were waiting for D-Day. We developed channels through OWI and other agencies to tell the truth about the American war effort and our war aims.
That was an important part of our psychological warfare. But now the war is over, how can you justify continuing this sort of program? Mr. Benton, hasn't the need for it diminished?
The need for that particular kind of program, the psychological warfare program, yes. But I believe very strongly that it has never been more necessary to tell our story abroad than right now.
That seems to call for a bit of explanation.
Well, I mean just this. We are one of the most powerful nations in the world today. A good many people in other countries think of us as the nation with the atom bomb, the B-29 planes, the huge navy and air forces. This impression is liable to give rise to misunderstanding. Yes, even fear and hatred if we don't make our aims clear and convince people that ours is a peaceful way of life. We can't have friendly, peaceful relations with other nations unless they understand us. We need to make a real effort to see that they do. Such a program as ours isn't a cure for suspicion and hatred, but it'll be a kind of a vaccination, let us say. And it is one of the cheapest ways I know to guard against friction with other nations.
Cheap in terms of dollars?
Yes. I read the other day that Major General Groves, testifying before a congressional committee, said that about $500 million and 35,000 people would be needed in the next year to manufacture and improve the atom bomb. I suggest that it would be good sense to spend 5, 10, or 15% as much on international information and cultural relations to help make the bomb unnecessary by producing international cohesion rather than fission.
It's a matter of our own security in the long run.
I think Loy Henderson here can tell us the importance of an information program from the point of view of a Foreign Service officer. Loy Henderson is a man who has risen in the Foreign Service from a vice consul 24 years ago to the post of minister to Iraq and now director of the Office of Near Eastern Affairs in the State Department. He's seen these problems at first hand. From your experience, Loy, what do you think?
Well, Bill, that experience has convinced me of the absolute necessity for making sure other people know exactly what we stand for, what we're striving for. Otherwise, hostility may develop towards us, and that would hamper us in our efforts to mobilize world opinion for peace.
I should think, Mr. Henderson, that our participation in the United Nations organization would be a pretty good guarantee of our peaceful intentions.
Perhaps, Mr. Fisher, but you have to remember that the success of the United Nations will depend on the extent to which the people of the different nations understand and trust one another. Now, people in every corner of the world are observing and wondering about developments in the United States. They have a real thirst for information about us, what we're like, and what our policies are.
You think that other people had no accurate idea of American life before the war?
I know they didn't. They had very little chance to know us. Their impressions were haphazard. They were based on scraps of news, sensational stories, odd bits of information. They knew more about American gangsters of the 1920s than they knew about American educational systems of the 1940s. They thought we were all very wealthy, and we got a lot of divorces every year. Thanks largely to the Axis propagandists, too many of them still think that we are a rich, tawdry, gun-toting, jazz-crazy, unscrupulous lot.
Oh, yes. Henderson, the American myth has some strange features and inconsistencies. We're a combination Uncle Santa Claus and Uncle Shylock, for example. And despite our record, some people think we have sinister imperialistic designs.
So, Uncle Sam, in the person of the State Department, is in the information field to correct some of these false impressions. Is that it, Mr. Benton?
Well, to help correct them. We're not really in it yet either. We're operating as well as we can with an interim setup until we are authorized by Congress to do the job ourselves. It's a highly temporary arrangement, a stopgap authorized by President Truman.
Actually, as yet, we have no congressional authority to establish a permanent international information service. The Bloom Bill, introduced by Congressman Sol Bloom, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, will give us that authority.
And that authority is essential to our foreign policy in this field. The Bloom Bill was unanimously approved in congressional committee only yesterday. But it is only the first of two steps necessary for carrying out this phase of our foreign policy. It will authorize us to take the second step, the money, to ask for funds so that we can set up a small but permanent staff of information officers abroad.
Mr. Benton, there's one question I think should be answered right here. Why should the government have to do all this? From all that you've said, it's obvious that private information channels didn't do too good a job of informing the world about America before the war. But does that mean it can't be done unless the government goes into the information business?
I want to make it clear that we won't be competing with private business in this field, and as a matter of fact, the government will be doing only a small part. The private press and radio and films have done a lot in the past, and we'll do what we can to encourage them to do still more in the future. They will do the main job of getting the facts out. Our job will merely be a supplementary one. Won't it, Stone?
Yes, Bill, but overseas press coverage of the American scene must necessarily be incomplete. It deals with spot news on a day-to-day basis. Such things as strikes and gangster shootings are bound to bulk pretty large, as they do in our own press, because they're news with commercial value. But not that the news services don't send plenty of solid stories, too, but they rarely transmit such things as the complete text of the president's speeches, important government documents, and the like. It will be our job to supplement the news agencies by making such material available to editors and others. And in addition, some feature articles on the American scene can be sent out. None of this would be complete without the news services. It would be entirely supplementary.
I can testify to the value of this sort of coverage from my experiences in Iraq. It has been of great value to us there.
You're referring to the OWI outpost in Iraq, Mr. Henderson?
Yes, I am. It worked quite a change during the war years. You see, there are no permanent representatives of American news agencies out there. And such news as they had from America was short items from the wire services or items copied from other papers. Only a few educated people had any real picture of America. Then OWI sent very able men in, and they filled in the missing link by issuing releases on developments in America. They were very widely used. In fact, I think it's safe to say that last year, the Baghdad press carried more news from American sources than from any other sources. Let me give you an example how this was done.
By all means.
Well, last summer, the regent of Iraq came to the United States and traveled extensively over here. OWI cabled daily reports of the regent's trip, where he'd gone, what he had seen, and background information on all this. When he visited our Supreme Court, the OWI representative in Baghdad furnished to the Iraqi press an account of the court and what it stood for. Such stories were headlined in the Iraqi papers almost every day for a month. The people were given an educational tour of the United States. It added up to the most impressive play of news in the history of the Iraqi press.
Now, what about the radio? We've had some powerful shortwave transmitters before the war. Mr. Stone, don't you think they did a good job?
Yes, they did. But even so, we were far behind the other major nations in our shortwave broadcasting. At the outbreak of the war, we had 13 transmitters owned by some 6 private corporations. They couldn't begin to carry the load. OWI leased them, and now new stations were built. Until early this year, we had 38 transmitters in operation, sending out programs in some 40 languages.
But now the war is over, do we need such an ambitious schedule?
No.
I'm thinking of us taxpayers.
Oh, of course not. We're cutting it way down. We will have fewer stations, and we have already cut the number of languages to 18. But that's still too much for private radio to handle. The private companies have done a lot, but they don't get enough financial return to make it possible for them to give any kind of complete news coverage or well-balanced cultural entertainment programs without government help.
What's the alternative, then, government operation?
We're still studying the question. It's possible that some sort of private or public corporation may take over the main job with government assistance and control. But we haven't taken any definite position on this as yet. We only know, Benton, that the job must be done.
Remember that other countries are in this field to stay. Early this year, Russia had 35 shortwave transmitters. Great Britain had 41. The Voice of America, as our broadcasts are called abroad, has been a great inspiration to people all over the world during the war. It should not be silenced.
And now, Mr. Benton, what about the content of our broadcasts? Would it be like the press coverage Mr. Stone described?
It'll be considerably broader. Our broadcasts will include world news and American news in brief, American editorial and radio comments, statements on American official policy from the president, congressional leaders, and prominent people in all walks of life. News from the Far East and from the American occupation zones in occupied Japan and Germany. And radio features on the American way of life and American science, education, the arts, and agriculture.
There'll be some, of course, who'll call this propaganda, Mr. Benton. How are you going to answer them?
Well, the word propaganda has bad connotations to many of perhaps most Americans. That's because they've learned to associate it with lies and half-truths told with a hidden purpose. But our aim will be to present a well-rounded picture of America and of American foreign policy. We'll present representative criticisms as well as praise. We won't select or distort the facts in order to give a completely favorable picture. The best propaganda in the long pull is the truth.
Mr. Stone, you're going to have to deal with this problem. Suppose a race riot occurs. Would you tell the world about that?
We won't hide the fact that we have social problems, Mr. Fisher. But we'll try to present them in perspective. We'll say, in effect, here's a problem in race relations. Here's how it came about. We don't like it, and we're trying to remedy it.
At the same time, we can describe some progress we are making toward removing the causes of racial conflict. And we must make it very clear that we don't consider ourselves a master race.
Now, there's one other main channel of information, Mr. Benton. That's the motion picture. Will you make some use of the films in getting our story across? Since you were interested in classroom films yourself before you came to the State Department, that ought to be right up your alley.
The motion pictures, Mr. Fisher, which commercial distributors send abroad, probably do more than any other one thing to form impressions of the United States. These impressions haven't always been fair to us. Too many people think that every American housewife has the 40-foot living room and a maid to wait on her. But on the whole, the movies have helped greatly to portray our way of life.
Yes, and sometimes they've made enemies, too, in Latin America and elsewhere. I understand that the British were quite incensed about the picture in which they asserted Errol Flynn recaptured Burma almost single-handed. Would you try to control film distribution to avoid that sort of thing?
I'll say this, Mr. Fisher. The State Department has no intention of censoring films for export. Any controlling that is done would be by the film industry itself, perhaps in consultation with government officials like Mr. Henderson here, who could give sound advice as to the reception certain films would get abroad, for instance, in Iraq. The movie industry has been most cooperative all through the war, and I'm sure it will continue to work for the common good in connection with our overseas work.
I understand you have some plans, though, to produce documentary films of your own.
On a very small scale, yes, if Congress approves. We plan to arrange for the production of a small number of non-commercial films strictly about life in the United States.
And Mr. Stone, what other channels will you use to reach the people of other countries? How about the magazines put out by OWI and its Latin American counterpart, the Office of Inter-American Affairs?
Most of these have already been discontinued, Mr. Fisher. The only exceptions are two magazines for Germany, published in cooperation with the Army, and one published in Moscow. The latter magazine, known as America, is the only American magazine distributed in the Soviet Union. We distribute 10,000 copies a month over there, and they're in great demand.
And don't forget, Stone, the information bulletin published by our embassy in Moscow. 200 copies of which go to Soviet officials daily. I suspect these 200 copies have the most influential circulation per copy in the world. These publications are very valuable in bringing about understanding of America. And if they are to be continued at all, the State Department must publish them. I think it is important that we do so. The Soviet Union isn't a one-man dictatorship, as so many people seem to believe it to be. Decisions there are often group decisions, and the opinions of top officials, and of the public, too, are a real factor in making them. We in America want the opinion leaders there to know as much as possible about America and Americans. There is great thirst for news of America in Russia.
Going back to your question about other channels of communication, Mr. Fisher, I think we ought to add that we're trying to build up circulation of American books and American magazines with overseas editions. We're continuing OWI's photographic exhibits about American life on a small scale. And last but not least, we're planning to continue the United States information libraries in the principal cities of the world.
Those information libraries have been widely used, Mr. Fisher, and have probably received more praise than any other aspect of OWI's and OIAA's work. Long lines of anxious people besiege these libraries everywhere.
Mr. Henderson, in questioning these information experts, I didn't mean to leave you out of the discussion for so long.
Oh, that's quite all right, Mr. Fisher. That's their province, and I'm getting a good briefing in the subject myself.
Well, I'd like to ask you, though, to give your evaluation of this whole program from the standpoint of the Foreign Service.
Well, let's put it this way. About 70 years ago, we started to give Japan all sorts of technical help toward becoming a modern industrial nation. I have often wondered whether the history of the last few years might not have been entirely different if we had also given the Japanese a better picture of our democratic way of life.
In that connection, Henderson, you'd be interested to hear that Brigadier General Fellers of General MacArthur's staff told me this week that the Japanese who knew America best were opposed to the military clique, opposed to the war. One former military attaché who had been stationed at the Japanese embassy here in Washington was thrown out of the Japanese army for his anti-war views. And a former Japanese naval attaché here in Washington was also dismissed. If more people in Japan had had the information these men had about America, the Japanese might never have gone to war with us. But go ahead, Lloyd.
Well, the program that Bill Benton and Bill Stone have been outlining, it seems to me, will work in two ways. It will give other peoples an accurate understanding of America, so they will know us better, and it will also help them to decide for themselves whether they want to go our way, towards democracy or toward totalitarianism.
Mr. Benton, to do the job Mr. Henderson envisages, you'll need some good people on your staff. Will you keep on your payroll most of the OWI and Office of Inter-American Affairs employees?
Mr. Fisher, we'll need very good people. And yet, at the same time, our peacetime staff will be comparatively modest. We still have a big job to do, of course, in Japan and in our occupation zone in Germany. There we have the problem of re-educating the peoples for democracy. But the period of psychological war is over. We expect to have only a few hundred doing information work overseas, perhaps one-fifth of what the war information agencies have employed during the war.
In Rome, for example, OWI staff had some 60 people. We expect to retain only about 20 on a permanent basis.
Will these 20, Mr. Stone, be taken into the Foreign Service?
Not immediately. We'll have to make special provision for them. One problem is to hold the best people.
As a member of the Foreign Service, I think it's essential that we retain them as part of the OWI staff. They have had valuable experience during the war years, and it would be a shame to lose them. Of course, they have made mistakes, but if we had to start from scratch, our people would probably make the same mistakes all over again.
How closely will the new setup work with international agencies in the same field? The United Nations Information Organization, for example, and UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Scientific, and Cultural Organization.
That's quite a mouthful, isn't it, Mr. Fisher? We're going to cooperate with UNESCO once it gets going. UNESCO will work on the United Nations level, whereas ours is a strictly American project. But we will work closely with UNESCO, especially in arranging cultural and educational exchanges. I'd like to say a word about our cultural relations program. This, of course, is a two-way program between ourselves and other countries. I believe that in the long run, these cultural exchanges will do even more than information work to build friendly relations with other nations.
You're speaking now, Mr. Benton, of exchanges of teachers and students?
Yes, and technicians and scientists. They are all included in our program.
Having taught in the Far East myself for a time, I am especially interested in educational exchanges.
China is a very good example of how that works out in practice. We're now helping to finance the education of Chinese students over here. Long before we started doing this, we earmarked for educational purposes the indemnity we were awarded after the Boxer Rebellion. As a result, some 2,000 Chinese students have come to the United States to complete their education. These people are now among the top figures in the Chinese government. They are our friends. They've done a lot to spread modern American ways among the Chinese people. Then a dozen or so American technical experts go to China each year to help modernize Chinese agriculture and industry.
And is this sort of thing to be extended to other countries?
Well, oddly enough, the State Department is authorized legally only to do this in Latin America. We've operated in China and the Near East only by using wartime emergency powers and funds.
The Bloom Bill, though, will authorize cultural exchanges of this sort with all nations.
Mr. Benton, how many exchange students do you plan to have come over here each year?
You can't plan it quite that way, Mr. Fisher. Many students come here on their own. There are, of course, also the formal exchanges arranged by the government. The total figure will be quite large. Even during the war, we had about 2,500 Latin American students in this country, most of them on their own. We expect to have 10,000 foreign students here in 1946 and 20,000 in 1947. I hope that will be only a beginning. I'd like to see the figure soar to 50,000 or even higher.
Mr. Henderson, hasn't a lot been accomplished in the Near East through education contacts with America?
Yes, but it takes a rather different form there, Mr. Fisher, and it goes back a century or more. Various American schools, in particular the American University at Beirut and Roberts College near Istanbul, have done a great deal to help the people of that region, and incidentally, to make them understand what America stands for.
Have you felt the effects of this as far away as Iraq?
There's no Arab country where you don't find graduates of the American University in Beirut in positions of top leadership. The Minister of Public Works, for instance, in Iraq, got his training there. I remember that in traveling through Kurdistan and other sections of northern Iraq, I found judges, doctors, and high public officials who had graduated from the same American university. Last year, when I visited Najaf, the holy city of the Shiite Muslims, I had a long talk with the Grand Mujtahid, who is the leader of the Shiites, the second largest Muslim group. Our translator, the local governor, turned out to be an alumnus of the American university. You find them everywhere.
And you felt that their contact with American teachers in Beirut had been beneficial from our own point of view?
Absolutely. A British official, who knows the Near East intimately, once told me that the understanding of American democracy and war aims gained by students at the American university was largely responsible for the loyalty of a great majority of Near Eastern people to the Allies, despite the frenzied propaganda of the Axis. That was important to us. Our line of communication was pretty thin out there at the peak of the Axis drive. If we hadn't had the support of the people, the Germans might well have smashed through to India to meet the Japanese. That might have been disastrous.
That's a very interesting angle. Now, to summarize what has been said, the Bloom Bill will authorize the State Department to set up a permanent international information service. The department will retain part of the OWI program, but on a reduced scale. It will service the press of foreign countries, broadcast on the radio, and use non-commercial films, exhibits, and publications to explain American policy and the American way of life to people everywhere. Bloom Bill will also open the way for a worldwide exchange of educational and technical personnel. In the long run, Mr. Secretary, you feel that this will be the best possible means of ensuring a permanent peace.
Mr. Fisher, it certainly is an absolutely essential means. It's a question of understanding versus force. America, to most peoples abroad, is a symbol of prosperity. If we can make it a symbol of the best democratic traditions as well, we will be helping to rid the world of hatred, suspicion, and the germs of future wars.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for giving us a forecast of the State Department's international information policy. And, Mr. Benton, we'll be coming back to you later with some questions about our domestic policy in releasing information, and especially the question of secrecy in our foreign policy.
You have been listening to the 43rd in a series of programs dealing with our foreign policy. On today's program, you heard Mr. William Benton, Assistant Secretary of State, Mr. William T. Stone, Director of the Office of International Information and Cultural Affairs for the State Department, and Mr. Loy Henderson, Director of the Office of Near Eastern Affairs for the State Department. Each week, the Armed Forces Radio Service brings you a discussion of international affairs by government officials and members of Congress. This program is presented to servicemen and women everywhere so that they may know what is being said and thought at home on the very important subject of our foreign affairs. Join us again next week for the 44th in this series of programs titled Our Foreign Policy, presented in cooperation with NBC's University of the Air. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service. Thank you.